seated, please. Court is now ready to hear argument in 070871 in Re United Services Automobile Association.
Ms. Barron will present argument for the relator. Mr. Geisel will present argument for the state of Texas. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Barron will open with the first 10 minutes and present the rebuttal.
Please, the court. At issue is whether the wrong court tolling statute, section 16064 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, applies to and saves Bright's statutory cause of action for employment discrimination when he filed a suit more than 3 years after the latest possible date permitted by the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act.
Do you agree with the Attorney General that whether it's jurisdictional or not really is something we don't need to address?
No, I don't. I think that the issue is a threshold question. It's hard to determine whether a trial court abused its discretion with respect to the merits unless you first determine that the trial court had jurisdiction to reach the merits. I also think the issue is squarely presented.
Well, if the general tolling provision applies,
yes,
then there's no jurisdictional issue, right?
There is still a jurisdictional issue because the trial court would not have had the ability to even get to the question of 16064 and whether it applies if she had no jurisdiction to reach the merits of that claim.
Because of the limitations?
Because of jurisdiction. If she had jurisdiction, she had to dismiss without even considering.
But the jurisdiction question depends on whether tolling applies, right?
Well, no, it doesn't, because I think the jurisdictional issue is dispositive, because if you look at the United States Supreme Court case in the U.S. Sand and Gravel case, and if you look at the Austin Court of Appeals decision in the Heart Hospital 4 case, what those cases recognize is that there are different kinds of statutory time limits. There are those that are like a statute of limitations because it protects a defendant's case-specific interest in having a claim properly resolved versus a jurisdictional statutory time limit which serves a larger, broader system-related purpose. And those that fall in the second category are jurisdictional, and if they are jurisdictional, they are not a pure statute of limitations, and so they are not subject to tolling or extension of limitations as a pure statute of limitations would be.
That just seems backwards to me. It seems like if you determine that the general tolling provision applies, then you don't get to the jurisdictional issue because it's tolled. And if it doesn't apply, then limitations is run by the terms of the statute. So why does it matter whether it's jurisdictional or not?
Well, I continue to say I think jurisdictional is a threshold question. I do think it's dispositive because if it's jurisdictional, you don't even get to looking at the general tolling statutes because it is a jurisdictional time limit. It restricts not just the right itself, but the power of the court to hear it.
As we've said, and the U.S. Supreme Court has said recently, we tend to not just consistently and blanketly look at these filing requirements for administrative proceedings as jurisdictional. We said that in Agal, and we cited some U.S. Supreme Court rationale in Agal where the trend seems to be the other way. What's the most compelling argument you have that this one should be jurisdictional?
Well, I think we have three key considerations that differentiate this case from those other cases that the court has held requirements not to be jurisdictional in light of Dubai. We have a longstanding controlling interpretation of the statute by this court as being jurisdictional, and we have legislative acceptance of that interpretation. We have what this court has repeatedly recognized, most recently in the City of Waco case, as a unique, comprehensive, and carefully crafted statutory scheme. And third, we have a unique statutory provision that is an integral part of that scheme. And going back to the sand and gravel company.
So the thing we're talking about is the 60-day. You get your right to sue letter, and you got to sue in 60 days.
We're talking about the two-year time limit, primarily.
Okay. And you've got to bring suit within 2 years of the occurrence, and nothing in the statute says, federal or state statute, says it's jurisdictional per se.
It doesn't say it per se, but I think it's helpful to have a little bit of background.
Background's great, but that's the question here. I mean, Schroeder, and we used to say all these things were jurisdictional.
Right.
And we got ourselves in a lot of trouble. And so now, after Dubai, we try to be a little more careful about saying what's jurisdictional or not. And Because if you're right that this is jurisdictional, if this was all filed one day past 2 years, it all goes to judgment. There's no appeal. And 10 years later they try to correct, you could stiff them because it's jurisdictional. The court had no jurisdiction to do anything. It was all a waste of time.
Well, I think that's not true with respect to this particular requirement. This is not a tricky requirement like the equal treaty rights requirement that the court was looking at in Dubai. You need to know two dates. You need to know the date they filed the complaint, and you know the, need to know the date they filed their suit. And we've had 17 years of experience with these.
But isn't there a policy behind the Civil Practice and Remedies Code that says sometimes you're going to file in the wrong court? We've got a very complex system. Some jurisdictions, some county courts of law have the same jurisdiction as district court. I mean, it's very hard to know. And doesn't the statute say, okay, you're going to make that mistake sometimes, but we're going to excuse the running of the statute of limitations as a jurisdictional matter? It talks in terms of jurisdiction. Why wouldn't that policy override this concern?
Well, I disagree that it talks in terms of jurisdiction. It talks purely in terms of statute of limitations. But going back to this whole concept, we have 17 years of experience under Schroeder. It has not been, we have not seen a rush to the courthouse to set aside these judgments. And as a practical matter, when the legislature adopted
Well, when I talk about jurisdiction, I'm in 16064. It says the period between the filing and the second filing is going to be excused and or limitation will be suspended if because of lack of jurisdiction in the trial court, which goes back to our holding in the underlying case, that sometimes you're going to file it in the wrong place.
That's correct, but I think that that provision has not been incorporated into the Commission on Human Rights Act. And I think what you look at is the TCHRA was adopted in a special session in 1983. There have been multiple attempts to set up a local deferral agency at that time. And two objectives. One, they wanted it local, and two, they wanted to avoid the problems in the federal system. And the legislative history shows that the federal system was backlogged, that it was taking way too long to resolve these complaints. And in fact, it's important to recognize that the two-year time limit in the Texas statute is unique. There is no parallel provision in the federal statute. Under the federal statute, all time for filing suit runs from the date the EEOC issues its notice of right to sue letter. And that can be 3 months, that can be 3 years, and that can be 5 years. And Texas did not want to adopt the federal system. So it adopted an absolute cutoff. And when this statute was first adopted, it said, in no event may suit be filed more than 1 year after the complaint is filed with the commission. Well, in no event does it mean, well, except for the event if you file in the wrong court.
So you think the 60-day limitation might be different?
It might be different, yes. It's in less definitive terms. It's not an absolute prohibition. It says may be filed. And there are cases, I guess early on, the Green versus Alcoa case that the court cited in Schroeder, all related to whether or not the one-year time limit should be told to wait for the commission to issue its notice of right to sue letter. And they said, no, this is an absolute statute. In no event means no, in no event. And if the commission doesn't issue its right to sue letter if you don't file within the 60 days of the right to sue letter, that doesn't matter. You have to meet the one-year deadline.
And your argument would be the same with respect to the other general tolling provisions, like incompetence or something like that.
Yes, and I think what we do see with statutory causes of action that when the legislature does want to provide for tolling, it can do that. It has done that in the example of the DTPA that the state cites in its amicus brief, and it's done several times in the workers' compensation statute where there are various tolling provisions. And that relates back to the core principle of these cases for the last 70 years on why we don't toll, because when the legislature creates a statutory cause of action, the elements of that cause of action, it's in derogation of the common law, are part and parcel of the substantive right. It is not part of the remedy. And what a statute of limitations does is it simply expands the time for seeking a remedy, but it doesn't enforce a right. So when you have a time limit that restricts the statutory cause of action, when that time is up, the right is extinguished. And a tolling provision might be able to expand a remedy, but it can't resuscitate a right that has been extinguished.
What is the language in 16064B intentional disregard of proper jurisdiction, how does that play into all this? Don't you have to show that they intentionally disregarded the rules for filing this case in the original court?
If 16-064 applies.
What if I think it does?
Well, it does. If it applies generally to age discrimination suits, it still doesn't apply in this case because Bright did file his first suit seeking $1.6 million in damages with intentional disregard for the county court's $100,000 jurisdictional limits. USA offered evidence, submitted evidence that showed first that he is charged as a matter of law with knowing what the jurisdictional limit of the county court was of $100,000. At the time he was terminated, his base salary was $74,000 and his bonus was $11,000. His petition sought salary, bonus, and other benefits for the rest of his natural life. And by signing the pleading, Bright's counsel certified that on reasonable inquiry, there were facts that would support that allegation. And so, assuming Bright was planning to live more than 1 year, we've exceeded the statutory limits of the county court. Bright went into this eyes open. Plus, we have other evidence in the record that supports that position.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from the state of Texas as amicus.
May it please the court. The most appropriate way of resolving this petition is to hold that the general tolling provisions in the CPRC do not trump the specific statutory deadlines in the labor code. And this follows from three separate factors. First, the default presumption against tolling. Second, the specific text that the legislature chose for the controlling provisions at issue. And third, the comprehensive legislative scheme that occupies this field and leaves no room to inject tolling into this statutory framework. I'd like to
How do we write that? There's lots of tolling. There's lots of limitations, provisions, and time limits in lots of statutes. Do all of them, is 16-064 not going to apply to any of them, too?
Under the default presumption, not to any specific statutory cause of action that has its own statutory deadline. The logic of the presumption is that when the legislature takes the time to enumerate...
Agree with me, there's probably maybe hundreds of those.
There are limitations that
are outside the Civil Practice and Remedy Code limitations chapter.
The question is...
I'm concerned about what I just did. If I adopt that and say, well, tolling doesn't apply to any of them, I may find out 5 years from now one that I feel that like that's a bad idea on. Is there any way to limit it just to this one?
There certainly is, Your Honor, and we think that the default presumption would control in this case, but the other way is to look specifically at both the comprehensive scheme that the legislature drafted for the labor code. It didn't include just one deadline.
You said default presumption. Is there an exception to that default, or is that just the rule always?
It is the rule, according to decades of precedent, when the legislature enumerates a specific deadline, but I think it applies with particular force here. And this
But have we ever held in any case that the tolling provision applies even when the legislature has specifically given a statutory limit time limit?
This court has not had occasion to address that issue, and if the court wanted not to address it in this case, it could resolve it by looking to the specific language that the legislature chose, in addition to the comprehensive detail that the legislature used for the labor code. And this court has, on multiple occasions, in Schroeder and City of Waco, held that the legislature took the time to carefully craft the remedies. It included a specific degree of detail, including deadlines to get into the administrative process, deadlines for how the commission is to carry out the exhaustion process, and then not one but two separate deadlines emerging from the administrative process in order to bring a cause of action. When the legislature takes that amount of time or takes that time to enumerate a cause of action in that degree of detail, it presumably included what it wanted in the statute and it left out what it wanted left out of the statute.
Well, it included in there when the suit should be filed and when the deadline should be, but it doesn't really answer the question that the legislature seemed to want, is that if somebody by mistake, and I understand you claim here it's an intentional act, that it was filed in the wrong court, but if someone just whoops, we have a pretty complicated court system in some places, and with overlapping jurisdictions and different court structures. And, you know, it seems to me the purpose behind 16064 was to prevent the sort of whoops situation that I filed in the wrong court. What's to say that by setting the deadlines in the labor code, the legislature didn't intend to allow some rope if somebody files in the wrong court? I don't see that they're completely at odds with each other.
Your Honor, I think they are at odds with each other given the policies of the labor code and given the balance of interests that the legislature was trying to accomplish.
If when the legislature looks at that, it has on occasion said no tolling, medical malpractice actions, for example. There's no tolling under most situations, and it's expressly stated in the statute. Not expressly stated here, though.
That's true, Your Honor. I believe the medical malpractice statute may have been geared to limiting what would have been a common law action, which is different than a statutory action. And that's why the statutory default rule applies in this case and not to that case. I also think that what the legislature was trying to do in response to Justice O'Neill's question is they realized that there is an important interest in providing a remedy for plaintiffs who've been wrongfully discharged. But there's also an important interest in preserving for businesses and for employers on a systemic level the ability to carry out their business without the distraction of protracted litigation. So the legislature provided a powerful remedy as an ancillary to federal law. And this doesn't mean by any means that a litigant can't seek recourse under Title VII if it chooses to do that. But under state law, the legislature was concerned with avoiding the situation of subjecting employers to litigation for years and years after the fact.
So your argument, even if a discriminatory act causes somebody to be rendered mentally incompetent, we wouldn't bring in tolling for mental incompetency. They intended 6 days and you're out of luck, regardless of what the discriminatory act did to you.
I see my time has expired, but...
Answer the question.
It was worth a try. I think the legislature could have included an exception if that's what it wanted to do, but it didn't for this case.
So and the answer is yes. Your argument would cover mental incompetency and everything.
It covers every tolling provision that is not included in the comprehensive scheme that the legislature enacted. And again, that would not necessarily cover federal claims under Title VII, but it would under state law.
Justice Weiner.
Thank you, Chief. Do you find it curious that the statutory saving or suspension provision in Chapter 16 specifically refers to lack of jurisdiction, which was our holding in the prior Bright case?
I don't, Your Honor. I think that statute, the predecessor to that statute, has been around for decades. I think that was balancing the situation where people brought suit in the wrong court under generally common law actions, not statutory actions.
And you think that is the linchpin? Statutorily created rights versus common law rights.
That is a linchpin for only one of our independent arguments under the default rule. It does not apply to looking to the specific text, as we discuss in our brief, and to the comprehensive scheme, as we discuss in our brief.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
May it please the court, Mr. Small will present argument for the real party in interest.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Small, and I represent Steve Bright. A critical point, and we jumped right to the jurisdiction right at the beginning, but a critical point here is that the USAA doesn't ever get to discuss the merits here because they don't qualify for mandamus relief in the first instance. At bottom, their argument is that just expense and delay is good enough to get them into court. And quite frankly, this court, I know, has wrestled with that issue quite mightily. But if the court accepts USAA's invitation today and grants mandamus relief here, the question's not going to be, is expense and delay enough? The question is going to become, how much expense and delay is going to get me into court? So that's the first issue. Going to the...
But we are concerned. I mean, this is a case with bad facts. As I understand it, 8 days after their plea to the jurisdiction was denied, you amend to... whoever trial counsel was, a man to say, we're seeing 1.6 million in a court with 100,000 jurisdiction. Am I right on that?
That sounds roughly.
So it starts close to look like this was a deal. What? Not saying anything about Mr. Bright, but what if we had a plaintiff who decided, I'm going to give my employer as much trouble as they gave me. I'm going to ask for $2 million in county court, and I've got a friend that's a county judge who'll let this rattle around for years, and I'm not paying any fees because I've got my lawyer's got this on contingency, and they're going to pay fees all the way to the Texas Supreme Court till the Texas Supreme Court says, you know, $2 million above $100,000. And then I'm going to go back and do it in the other court, and they're going to have to pay all these. I mean,
well,
this makes this case a little different from just if this had happened in some other way. It doesn't. What can we take into account on mandamus if somebody's trying to abuse the system?
In this particular circumstance, I don't think you can.
In my hypothetical, somebody who knew there was no jurisdiction filed it there just to make the other side waste fees.
Judge, I don't think you can. But that being said, because you send this back and say that USAA has an adequate remedy by appeal, we don't win hands down, because I promise you USAA is going back to the trial court and they want to talk about intentional disregard. I've got the stack of exhibits that they'll bring. But the answer to your question is no. That this is not the case where that happens.
And I'm wondering why that is. I mean, on discovery, we rarely get involved in discovery disputes. We do get involved when somebody has just gone way too far overboard. And yes, that's a judgment. But we haven't, in fact, been flooded with discovery disputes because everybody knows it's got to be really bad before we're going to do mandamus. Would there be? Why wouldn't this be such an exception?
I think the problem that you run into talking here at this court about what Mr. Bright knew, what Mr. Bright's counsel intended, gets you into a factual morass that you won't be able to extract yourself from. Counsel made reference to what the evidence shows or what the evidence showed at trial, and the evidence showed at trial that we put on evidence and we believe we proved a number within the jurisdictional limits. Now,
but the question is, if let's assume that you won't like this hypothetical, but the court agrees with USAA 9-0 that the Civil Practice and Remedies Code doesn't apply, and the trial court had no option here. Wouldn't it be better just to put you out of your misery then, and decide that here and now rather than denying relief and letting it percolate around in the trial court?
I still don't think that you can get to it, Judge, because you've got the factual issues and what is. You know, what was the intent? And that historically, except in extraordinarily rare circumstances, has always been a fact issue for a trier of fact. And I don't think this record in this kind of a procedure gets you there.
But I guess my question is, if there's no fact issue on intent, and we just say you filed this suit beyond the two-year limitations period, we say as a matter of law, 16.064 doesn't apply, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, that's kind of what we're struggling with. If we see a record and we know it as a matter of law, the plaintiff or the defense, it doesn't matter, it's not going to get anywhere further in this case on the merits or on jurisdiction. Why not decide it during mandamus if it's before us?
I suppose in a hypothetical where you've got a recording of the trial or going, yeah, we're going to run up the bill. And we're going to do this and that and the next thing to make their life miserable. But the other side of that is when you get into the intentional disregard issue is it makes no sense for Mr. Bright. It makes no sense for Mr. Bright's counsel to make a conscious decision to mess this up. We're now 7.5 years after Mr. Bright got terminated, and he still has no relief, and USAA has no resolution to the issue.
But here's what I have a hard time getting my mind around, is if the face of the petition shows damages in excess of the jurisdictional limit, if you could tell that from reading the petition, what kind of intent inquiry is there?
The face of the petition doesn't show that.
Well,
I think several things. If you'll recall, Justice O'Neill, the underlying case here dealt with front pay, and the argument was that because of the speculative nature of front pay and because of the fact that Mr. Bright might have had a job.
Well, that goes to whether you can recover it. But, I mean, the fact that you've pled for it, you've asked for front pay in excess of the
was it within the jurisdictional limits of the court or wasn't it within the jurisdictional limits of the court? And the conundrum that trial counsel's faced with is, do you put a number out there, it could be this much?
No.
And
I think you fairly evaluate the case. If you're asking for future damages, including loss of income benefits for the balance of the plaintiff's life, you take all that in evaluation. You as a lawyer, whoever the trial lawyer, should know what the value of that case is. And when you don't do it right, you put your client at risk, like this client, your client is here now. Put him at risk that if he gets a judgment, he's not going to keep it. So maybe the relief should be against the lawyer for malpractice.
Well, I would tend to disagree with that, Your Honor. The evaluation is made, obviously, at the time that the suit is filed in May 2002. This pleading that we're talking about a year and 6 months later, that has, or actually I think it was a discovery answer a year and 6 months later, has a different number in it, but it's an issue of, do you put a number out there and say it could be as much as this, or not put a number out there and then have USAA go, well, you never disclosed that this was a possibility, you're out of luck.
So what happens if you do put a number out there and say it's $99,999.99, and the jury comes with something greater than that? Are you limited to what you plead?
There have been cases, particularly in county court, where that has been the finding.
But that was not the case here.
No.
I mean, from the petition, if you look at front pay, it's over $100,000 by anybody's account.
Well, it's over $100,000, but that's presuming that Mr. Bright's not reinstated. That's presuming that Mr. Bright doesn't have a job, because if he's got a job, there is no front pay.
But why take a chance? You've got the district court and you've got the federal district court. Why not file someplace else that's got jurisdiction?
That's...
And why do it over and over and over again?
Well, that... I don't know the answer to that one. But I can tell you that in discussing the matter with trial counsel, that the judgment was made in good faith to file it in county court at law in the best interest of his client. This was not a decision that was made to skirt anything or to intentionally disregard what the limits were, because here we are 7.5 years later and he has nothing.
The relator says that it matters whether the statute's jurisdictional. The amicus state says it doesn't. What's your view?
Well, my view is that you have to back off and take a look at the bigger picture.
And I want you to do that, but I just want to know, does it matter whether it's jurisdictional or not, or just mandatory? I mean, don't you lose on that issue either way?
No. Is it jurisdictional? I think if you look at the big picture, you look at Title VII, and you have to look at Title VII, you have to look at the ADEA in this circumstance, because Chapter 21 was modeled on Title VII and taken virtually verbatim for the express purpose of effectuating Title VII. And when you go back and look at what the trend is and where these issues are going in terms of jurisdictional or just mandatory, the courts are relatively uniformly moving away from a holding that it's jurisdictional and finding that these are treated instead as statutes of limitation, where tolling, waiver, estoppel apply. It gets into the whole issue that you were discussing with counsel earlier, and the reason that we don't think we lose, Justice Hecht, is because we think that taking the policy considerations behind Title VII and the policy considerations behind 16064, that they fit together. And there was some discussion in the briefing and some discussion here that there's some presumption to be made by the legislature not including tolling specifically in Chapter 21. And my response to that is there wasn't any reason to include tolling in there. It was already out there, and the legislature knew that.
You agree that the legislature could impose a hard and fast deadline, and the only question is, did they in this case?
I don't think they did.
But, I mean, you agree they could.
They could. They could, but I don't think they did, because if you look at Chapter 21, there's no language, specific language, that says these timelines, you meet them or you're dead. And I think that when you look at the overall purpose of Chapter 21 to eliminate the twin evils of discrimination and retaliation, that the state's focus is too narrow. It's the time and the efficiency certainly are part of the picture, but they're not the focus of Chapter 21. And by using the tolling provisions, you get over the hump of the incompetence, the wrong court. If Mr. Bright had filed 25 miles up the road in Kendall County, he wouldn't have any problem, because county court up there has unlimited jurisdiction. But when you go back and look at 5539A, which is the predecessor to 16.064, it was enacted under the title "An Act to Extend the Period of Limitation of Any Action in the Wrong Court," clearly directed at fairness and equity. Now, Texas is...
And that was the bill title in the...
That was the bill title in 1931 when the predecessor to 16064 was enacted. And there's not much explanation between 1931 and Gutierrez versus Lee in 1991. The cases just say 16064 doesn't apply to a statutory cause of action. But what you find, and I've taken to calling 16064 the "oh, and besides that" rule, because when you look at the cases like Hart and some of these others, Hart Hospital, for instance, the case wasn't dismissed. The plaintiff voluntarily non-suited it. Oh, and besides that, 16064 doesn't apply to save it. Gutierrez versus Lee, the first court hadn't dismissed the case yet before the second case was filed. Oh, and besides that, 16064 doesn't apply to statutory rules, but they never explain why. So when you go back and look at it, the bill title said it applies to any cause of action, and I would suggest that tolling should apply to Chapter 21 here, so that the complainants get the full benefit of the maximum benefit under the law.
And does your argument extend to
all statutory cause of action that aren't explicit the other way, and to all tolling provisions?
I can't answer that except to say that it would apply to statutes that don't have explicit jurisdictional language in them, such as the statute that was enacted after, what's that, Lautzenheiser, or whatever the name of that one was. But the whole point of 160064 is remedial in nature, and it's designed to get people out from under the penal limits of a statute of limita- or of a statute of limitation where they're going to get dismissed.
So if you're correct there, then that case would go back down, and then the whole issue of whether or not it was intentionally misfiled, that would be decided by, I guess, a trial judge or perhaps a jury on that issue.
I don't know how that would fall between a judge and a jury, but exactly.
It'd decide here. Right?
Somebody would have to look at the issues. The factual issues underlying who knew what and when they knew it.
That's something we can't decide here, correct?
I don't think you can get there, Justice Medina. It's typically something that this court avoids, and if you see the record, you'd make sure that you wanted to avoid that. But the trend has been with this jurisdictional and mandatory that the federal courts, starting with Zipes, well, actually not starting with Zipes, but Zipes in 1982 was one that got away from the finding these time requirements jurisdictional. The Koch case out of the Fifth Circuit in 1981 or 82 also moved in that direction, and among the federal circuits, the Seventh Circuit was the last holdout. But even there, Judge Posner took to heart the application of tolling, and while the language that he used was somewhat restrictive, he too agreed that in the interest of fairness that tolling should apply in a Title VII circumstance. Now, interestingly, the Seventh Circuit, before they even came to that conclusion regarding Title VII, they had already found that the time limitations in the ADEA were not jurisdictional. So with all of that said, I don't think that the court even has to go to the merits of this. I don't think USA qualifies for mandamus relief here. But if you do, I think that the court should find that that these time limits in Chapter 21 are not jurisdictional, and that tolling does in fact apply.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Small.
Mr. Barron, what about Mr. Small's opening and I guess closing comment that you don't even qualify for mandamus relief? I mean, where is mandamus review going to end if we start granting mandamus every time somebody pleads an affirmative defense like limitation?
Well, I don't think you have to do it every time somebody pleads an affirmative defense. It's a selected remedy. It's a balancing remedy. You balance the benefits versus the cost of issuing mandamus relief. Here, where you have an issue that's been percolating, where there's uncertainty in an area where employers and employees alike both need a certain rules, where these cases need to be filed and when they need to be filed by. It's a big issue. It's dispositive of this case. And really, it's going to be a waste of time.
So you're in favor of mandamus review in general when the court knows as a matter of law the answer and can prevent a needless trial. Is that your stance?
I don't think that's always going to be the case. It's the balancing issue because, as the court noted in the McCallum case, there is a benefit of having justice or the appearance of justice in going and having full trials. And often in these kind of cases, there will be benefit from expanding the factual analysis and exploring more the record. But in this case, we can go back, we can have a trial that lasts a year, and the two dates aren't going to change. And I think the court has noticed in the Kosoglu case, that we don't send cases back for unnecessary trials
but
that aren't
going to
advance the ball.
But there will be many cases when the summary judgment record won't change either, and a trial court refuses to grant a summary judgment. And everyone knows, as a matter of law, the trial court should have granted it. So under that standard, when it's very clear what the answer is, should we be granting mandamus relief in, like, a no-evidence summary judgment case or summary judgment where the evidence
right.
is conclusively established?
Well, I think that goes back to the same question, whether you need it for the appearance of justice. And I think in McCallum, what the court recognizes is that if you have to go through one trial, maybe the balance comes out one way. But if you go to a second trial, then we're starting to make our system look like it doesn't know what it's doing. And we don't go there. The balance changes when you start going back for second trials or third trials. And this is a case where USAA has been submitted now first to one completely unnecessary trial in a court that lacked jurisdiction, when the plaintiff could easily have filed this case in district court. And all the numbers, this wasn't rocket science, $85,000 for the rest of his natural life. He could have filed this case in district court. It clearly exceeded $100,000 at the time it was filed. And I don't think the court needs to get to the intentional disregard issue because the other two are dispositive, but if you do, there is not a fact question. Bright submitted no affidavits, no testimony, no record whatsoever in response to the combined plea to the jurisdiction and motion for summary judgment.
So you're not arguing that mandamus relief is available every time a trial court rejects a defendant's pretrial motion asserting limitations?
Absolutely not.
And if the two-year limit is enforceable by plea to the jurisdiction, so would be the 60-day?
The 60-day, I think we would have to analyze separately because it does have different language. It does have the fact that it has previously been interpreted by the court to be a jurisdictional limit. And just on jurisdiction, can I briefly say that the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed a statutory time limit issue twice in the last year, in the Bowles versus Russell case and the John R. Sand and Gravel case. And there the court recognized that jurisdictional treatment of statutory time limits makes good sense. And in both those cases, the court said, we have issued a controlling interpretation of the statute as having jurisdictional impact, and despite the modern approach, we're going to continue under the doctrine of stare decisis to continue to give those statutes jurisdictional effect. And the court recognized that stare decisis of statutory construction cases makes particularly good sense because the legislature is always free to go back and fix it. And here we've had 17 years under Schroeder. In virtually every legislative session, the legislature has come back and tinkered with the Commission on Human Rights Act. It has revised it. It has recodified it. It has even altered the time for filing the suit, expanding it from 1 year to 2 years.
Is your argument that if it is jurisdictional, you don't address the tolling question?
Correct. Unless it were within the jurisdictional restriction itself, you would not look elsewhere to restrictions that apply only to traditional statutes of limitations.
I'm just trying to see how in the world you'd ever avoid addressing the tolling argument.
Right.
And I don't understand how. I think you agree that however you decide it, even if you said it's jurisdictional, you've still got to address the point that the tolling provision saves it.
Well, the tolling provision by its own term only applies to statutes of limitations. A jurisdictional statutory time limit is not a statute of limitations.
At that point.
Right.
But you acknowledge you've got to reach the tolling point.
Right. But the jurisdictional, if it's jurisdictional, it resolves the tolling point, I guess is my point. Correct.
I hear you.
If it's jurisdictional, it's game over because the tolling provision on its face doesn't purport to impact or expand jurisdiction, is the point.
You've still got to deal with it, though. You've got
yes,
to address
yes.
tolling.
Correct.
So if tolling saves it, Okay, we've been there.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. The cause is submitted. That concludes arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oye, oye, oye. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.